gone to Sherbrooke with a faculty position, and he did early specific heat measurements and susceptibility measurements in the group that kind of basically helped set up the experiments that the systems that we used here. Okay, so maybe a lot of you know this, or almost everybody, but maybe there's someone in the room that doesn't know this. Frustration in magnetism is this triangle is the kind of the simplest building block for that, where if you have an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, then these two spins would like to be anti-aligned. And then if you have a triangle, this one can go either up or down, and that gives you a degeneracy. And you get, if you have a large triangular lattice, you'll have a very high level of degeneracy. And then that's interesting because at low temperatures, you won't get ordering, and it'll take subtle other interactions that could maybe break that frustration, and you can see interesting phases. So an example of this type of frustrated system is dysprosium titanate. In this case, the dysprosiums like to sit on the corners of these tetrahedra, and the dysprosium titanate can be replaced. The dysprosiums can be replaced with other elements, which will give different magnetic properties. For example, holmium has a very similar characteristic as dysprosium, where you have an Ising-like orientation, or the spins would like to point either in to or out of the tetrahedra. The dysprosium doesn't have a nuclear term. The holmium has a high nuclear heat capacity at low temperatures, which kind of is not so good for, well, it'll mask the other features. So we're studying the dysprosium titanate at the moment. Okay, and so one of the interesting things about dysprosium titanate is that, let's see, well, I can go from here. Basically, what happens is you can look at it as an analogy to water ice. In case of water ice, you have the hydrogens, two would like to cant in and two would like to go out, and that would be the ground state of each of these tetrahedra. But what Linus Pauling found was is that there'd be a high level of degeneracy where there'd be no long-range order, and that the tetrahedra would go into a two-in, two-out state at low temperature, but there would be no order between the tetrahedra. And so this system here with the Ising spins pointing in and out can go into a two-in, two-out state and be very similar to the water ice. And Ramirez et al. Made a heat capacity measurement in 1999, which kind of showed that. This is the specific heat divided by the temperature from 12 Kelvin down, where the phonon contribution was subtracted away. So this is the magnetic term. And what you can see, if you take the area under this curve, that's the entropy change. And so if you start with Arlon 2 at high temperature, saying that it's completely a disordered magnetic system going down, by the time you get to zero temperature, not all of the entropy has been removed. And this residual entropy happens to have the same value as the water ice system that Linus Pauling described. Okay, another early measurement, and that's why it's called spin ice, because it's similar to water ice. And another early measurement on this system is by two different groups, Matsuhira and Schiffer. And so what they found was that the relaxation rate of the system would slow down at high temperatures. This is 1 over the temperature. And so this is where the spins become Ising-like. And then there's this quasi-plateau region, and then it would continue to slow down. And that the barrier to relaxation, this is a kind of 3 points describing an Arrhenius behavior, but that relaxation would be consistent with a barrier to relaxation of 10 Kelvin. And so this is the different early specific heat measurements. And you can see the time constants for this at 1 Kelvin. This is about 10 hertz. So it's getting pretty slow. Okay, so then later on, in 2000, Zinger's group did work showing that you can describe the Hamiltonian for the system as a nearest neighbor effective exchange interaction. And there'd be this J effective. And the dysprosium titanate and the holmium titanate, one has a 1.8 Kelvin and the other has 1.1 Kelvin energy. And they looked at, in this work over here, they looked at, they did a numerical simulations using Monte Carlo and using a special loop algorithm that would allow the system to thermally equilibrate quicker. They could identify a peak that could exist at very low temperatures. And they were able to describe the heat capacity of Ramirez et al. Very nicely. And so this ordered state has not been observed at this time, at this point. And what it would look like would be there's a kind of a complicated multi-tetrahedral unit cell of repeating pattern here that that would meet the release of the entropy. Okay, and so the monopole picture comes later, and a lot of people might know the Castelnuovo and the Joubert-Holdsworth work, but actually Rishkin in 2005 has a paper that describes this monopole picture. And what it is that if you have these tetrahedra in a two-in and a two-out state, when you're at low temperatures, an excitation could be a single spin flip, and when that single spin flip occurs, you can end up having, if you look at the dumbbell model, you can have like a plus and a minus to each of these spins, and you'll have a net positive and a net negative magnetic monopole in the system. And so then you have a plus and a minus created by a single thermal excitation. And so this is a really neat thing about the monopole picture, is that you can then think of this thermal excitation creating this plus and minus monopoles, and then a single spin flip, let's say over here or here, can make this blue minus one here move away, and then a single spin flip can make it move away. So that single spin flip is just taking the two-in, these are all two-in, two-out states, and this is a 3-1 and a 1-3 state, and you can make the 3-1 and the 1-3 wander apart. And then they can wander around and the energy for that spin flip is it's conserving the energy because you're just keeping one excitation, but these have now separated. Okay, and so then with this monopole picture, one of the things you see is that there's an energy of interaction for these monopoles, which is like a Coulomb-like interaction. And another thing that it can be used to do is you can look at screening effects. And it could potentially, it could describe the time constant from the early susceptibility measurements. So when you're looking at the temperature, as you're cooling it, the spins are slowing down, and the experiment actually doesn't follow a simple Arrhenius model, but it slows down faster. And what Joubert and Holdsworth and also Castelnuovo has a model which would explain this difference. Okay, and so if you look closely, you see that this is the experiment, and this is the theory, that the experiment actually is slowing down faster than these theories. So although they're good at describing this slowing down, it's not perfect. Okay, and so then what we can do is see that as we're cooling this time constant is becoming very, very long. There's thermodynamic measurements that were done on this dysprosium titanate. There's the Orendak and Klemke. And so this is the Orendak work, and this is the Klemke work. And what they are doing here is they're getting a time constant off of the thermal relaxation of the system. In this case here, they use a demagnetization experiment where they're changing the magnetic field, and they're looking at the heat released when the field is changed. And so they're going to lower frequencies and temperatures, and they can see kind of an Arrhenius behavior. In the case of Klemke, he sees two different time constants, one that kind of agrees with the theory and one that agrees with the early Snyder data. So we worked on susceptibility measurements using a squid to go to lower frequencies and temperature, and this is the configuration that we use for that, where we have a counterwound coils, we have a sample that will misbalance this coil, and so then the susceptibility or the magnetization of the sample will be picked up by the squid. And so then this has the ability to measure very low frequencies, so basically we're limited by the patience of of, well, our patients. And so this is the configuration of two different measurements we have. One is a hand-wound squid system, where this is the coil for the excitation. There's a niobium shield. This squid ends up getting loaded in there. And then this is the niobium shield that covers the whole thing to avoid any kind of interference from outside of the lab or outside of the doer. Okay, and so then this is a different configuration where we have a planar gradiometer, where we have a homemade squid set up, where we have two counterwound coils on chip. We drilled a hole through the substrate, and we run a needle through it of the dysprosium titanate. And so we can then measure the magnetization and the susceptibility of the dysprosium titanate. This has a better balancing than this, so we can then raise and lower the field without losing the lock of the squid. And so this is the data that we have for the susceptibility. And so we can see as we cool it, the chi double prime as a function of frequency is going to lower and lower frequencies. The peak of that is the characteristic frequency of the spins. And so if we plot that as 1 over T, we can see we can extend the data of Schiffer's group, and we find a similar slope to that what they were getting, but we can really kind of define it nice, you know, with more confidence. And this offset over here is a simple, well, two different errors. One is the Schiffer's group didn't have a demagnetization correction of the sample for the geometry of the sample. And another one is they have a 2 pi error in their conversion of frequency to time constant. And so then that's just kind of been carried around through the literature. But this is hopefully the correct data over here. Okay, and so if we look at this slope, one of the puzzles is why is this barrier to relaxation around 10 Kelvin? And I'll just bring up a kind of just so people know, we measure the other material, HTO, and it's supposed to have approximately a factor of 2 different J effective, and yet we still get around a 10 Kelvin barrier to relaxation. So that's kind of a puzzle of why, what's determining that slope exactly. But the reason I'm talking about this, I'm just going to be a heat capacity talk, but the point is that with the susceptibility measurement is saying that at half a Kelvin, the frequency and the time constant of this system is a millihertz, so 1,000 seconds. So these spins are becoming very, very slow in responding to magnetic fields. And so they probably should also be slow at responding to temperature changes. And so we have to be very careful about if we're studying the amount of energy that can be absorbed or released by these spins, we have to be very careful that we're waiting long enough for that heat to enter and for it to escape. So just some more details about the susceptibility measurement is when you look at the susceptibility, there's not a perfect exponential. Actually, if you look at the line width in this chi double prime, it's described by two Lorentzian peaks of different amplitude. And there's another group, Masahiro's group, later had work where they did the measurements to lower temperatures such just like us, and we have perfect agreement of with these two time constants. We looked at the line width of that, and working with Patrick Hanelius, he did not feel that this two time constant fit was really a good description of the system, but felt it was more likely a stretched exponential. And so he looked at our data and analyzed it as a stretched exponential and did a transform to look at what could be determining these shapes, and then did comparisons to numerical simulations. And well, this is some data where we have the magnetization, and that's not following an exponential. It's more like a stretched exponential. And so the conclusion of his work, it's published in this paper over here, is that the line shape or the relaxation in this magnetization would be consistent with maybe a stuffing of 0.3%. So there'd be an additional amount of dysprosiums that could be sitting within some of the tetrahedra that could be causing a long time tail that we're seeing in the susceptibility. And also there could be some kind of a surface effects or disorder that's causing the stretching. And he has an explanation of the time constant being slower by saying that there could be a temperature-dependent spin flip that's proportional rate that could be proportional to the monopole density. Anyways, that's in this work over here. And so the point here is that we see that we have very good quality material that we're studying. 0.3% stuffing is a very small amount of stuffing, but that could be something that we're seeing in our susceptibility measurement. And so then when we look at the time constant of the measurement that we have, this is the relaxation time as a function of 1 over the temperature, we see at half a Kelvin, we have something that's over 100 seconds. And if we were going to go to much lower temperatures, you can see you can get to even a million seconds of relaxation if it follows the Arrhenius behavior. The Matsuhira group did magnetization measurements to lower temperatures, and it deviated from that. Okay, so this is now back to the specific heat. So this is kind of a motivation for looking at the specific heat, is that we look at Ramirez, and what they did was, in their heat capacity measurement, they only had a 15-second time window for making the heat enter and leave the system to determine the energy that's released from the spins in changing temperature. Okay, and so 15 seconds could be fine at these high temperatures, but when you start going to the low temperatures, there could be a problem where they're actually not waiting long enough for the energy to come in and out. And if you look at Klemke, they had 600 seconds. And so this is, according to the susceptibility measurement, the time constant of the spins is for 600 seconds, and this is the temperature where it would be 15 seconds. So this is could be having problems with Klemke's results, where he's getting a lower reading for the specific heat because he's just not waiting long enough to actually detect the specific heat from the spins. And so this is Melko and Gingra and Den Hertog's numerical work, where they were using the Ramirez data to get parameters and where they got this ordered state. And so this is just a comparison that maybe what we could do is measure at these temperatures over here, wait long enough and see whether we can see this deviation in the specific heat. And there's other work. This is the Klemke work where they had 600 seconds time constant. And what you see is that they have a higher value of heat capacity, but they also have the peak has moved to lower temperatures. So there's kind of an error between or difference between the Klemke work and the Klemke work and the Ramirez work. And so there's a difference there. And then we look at other groups, Higashinika. They've got something that has a peak at around the same temperature as Klemke, but it drops down faster, but they don't say what time constant they used. So that might be why this is dropping out. They didn't have 600 seconds. They could have had something shorter. And then this is Katawaki. And so you can see this peak is more or less there, and it's coming down at a different point. And then Morris, peak around there, and coming down somewhere in there. And so the groups were not going to very long times, and so they're just dropping out probably because of their time constant. And so if we look at Klemke, which seems to be the one of the nicest sets of data, you get concerned that if the heat capacity is higher and the peak is at a lower temperature, that the entropy change could be even beyond the Pauling value. But when you analyze this area under this curve after the subtracting of the phonon term, you see that they can approach the Pauling value very nicely, while Ramirez actually was undershooting a little bit. So there was some room for error in the heat capacity without violating this Pauling value. So then our heat capacity measurement is set up over here. And what we did was we set it up to be a very slow measurement. And so what we have here is a sample that we got from McMaster, and we're gluing a tiny resistance thermometer to it. These little pins are the same size as like for a chip carrier, for like a TTL chip or something. So these are pretty small. And then what you see here are 6-micron diameter fibers from shreds from a dental floss. So we take dental floss and we shred it up to the finest amount, and then we super glue it across here to make a suspension. And then what we have are very fine 6-micron niobium titanium wires that are connected to the thermometer. And then we have a thermal link of platinum tungsten that we glue to the sample, and that's silver epoxide. And so this is supposed to be the dominant flow of heat for letting this sample relax. So this is the schematic of this. We have a sample, We have a we put in a dominant thermal link, this platinum tungsten. We have a thermometer that's glued onto the sample and a heater that's glued onto the sample. And then there are these very fine niobium titanium wires running off of here that should be drawing as very little heat flow. And so there's different ways of measuring specific heat, AC method, quasi-adiabatic. For these very long time constants, the nicest way to do this is a thermal relaxation method. And so we're following actually a very nice paper by Takano and Andraka's group. It's a conference proceeding. It's kind of pretty obscure paper that David found. And what was nice about it was is that usually for a thermal relaxation method, people use a two tau or a single tau relaxation to analyze the specific heat. So this time constant for the relaxation goes as the specific heat of the sample divided by the thermal conductivity of the weak link. So what you do is you apply heat to the sample, and that warms the sample up, and then you release, turn off the heat, and you see it then equilibrate back to the reservoir temperature. And so the stronger the thermal link, the faster it'll relax, and the smaller the heat capacity, the faster it'll relax. And so you measure that time constant, and it gives you the heat capacity if you know K. Okay, but what happens if it's a spin ice system or spin glass system is that you can have a distribution of relaxation times. The time constant for releasing the heat from the spins could be very, very long, and it might not be an exponential even. And so it'll cause a distortion or a stretching of that exponential relaxation. And so not even a two tau model will fit. And so what happens, what this group explained, and it's very, very simple actually, is just that don't even think about the exponentials and just look at the heat flow. The heat flow is equal to the thermal conductivity of that weak link times the temperature difference. So then that's the number of watts leaving the system. And just integrate that over time, and that gives you the energy change. So don't worry about what the shape of that curve is. Just measure delta T, understand what K is, determine Q dot, integrate over time. And so then that's what we did. And so this is an example of some data we have where what we do is we warm up the sample to 5% or 10% of the nominal temperature, the reservoir temperature, and then we turn it off and we see it relax. And so this is on a log graph. We can see the heat leaving the system and relaxing to equilibrium. And this is 200,000 seconds. And so what we see is that this is not an exponential, and it's a kind of an unusual time constant. But when we integrate this, we can then get the energy change for changing the spins from, let's say, 350 to 340 milli-K. Actually, yeah, it could be longer than that because we have to wait for the heat to get in, and then we have to, and then we have to wait for the heat to get out. And this over here is the helium transfers for when we get a little spike there. And so we eliminate that. Luckily, what happens is the system is so slow at absorbing heat or releasing heat that the disturbance of this doesn't give, we would see an offset if there was a problem here. And so we just take that part out of our analysis. So we just do a numerical integration of this part over here. And now we have a new doer where instead of having a transfer every day, we can transfer every 20 days so we can avoid these kind of disturbances. Okay, and so then this is the data of as a function of different temperatures. And so this is 1 Kelvin down to 340 milli-K. And what these dotted lines are is the times range that Ramirez used and the time range that Klemke used. And so you can see over here, this looks very nice and linear. This relaxation here is just due to C over K, and K is changing due to the Wiedemann-Franz law, and C is very, the time constant of releasing the heat is faster likely in the spins than the time constant of just C over K, so it looks nice and linear. But as you get colder, you start getting a curvature, and that's when you're actually starting to become limited by the speed at which the spins can release their heat. And so this is an indication that, well, you've got to be careful about your time constant and whether you're going to account for all of the heat. And so when Ramirez did this, it would be very difficult for him to see any of that curvature. And Klemke, I would think they could have seen this, but somehow they missed that. And so then this is when we go to even longer times, out to here. And so when I, earlier data I showed you went out way beyond that, but that's nothing is changing qualitatively. And you can see at low temperatures, which is the blue lines, there's quite a bit of area under the curve that could be unaccounted for if you just assumed an exponential recovery off of the early time data. And so when we analyze that for the different temperatures, we can see now that we can get an upturn in the specific heat that the other groups were not seeing. And it's not exactly like what Melko and Den Hertog and Gingra saw in their loop algorithm, Monte Carlo, but it's an upturn, and they saw an upturn. And it's kind of unusual that it's upturning at a higher temperature, and that this is not coming down as close to zero as they had. And so what it's saying is that the system is this is monopoles in the spin ice state over here. But what's happening is the ordering is starting to kick in while the monopole dynamics are occurring over here. And so this two in, two out vacuum is probably already starting to order in some way. So yeah, there's still two in and two out, but there's going to be an ordering of between the tetrahedra already occurring. And we're getting an upturn. And let's see. This is the idea that, you know, the susceptibility, we were saying that there could be a stuffing effect. And so there was a concern that this upturn could have been from this 0.3% stuffing. So what we did was we measured a powder sample that should be less sensitive to stuffing effects because of it's grown at a lower temperature, and so there should be less evaporation of titanium. And what we see is that we're saying getting a consistent result with the single crystal. We couldn't get to as low temperatures because the time constant was long because of the powder having a very poor thermal conductivity. But we're going to continue working on that and see if we can mix it with silver and speed that up. Actually, this was already mixed with silver, but maybe we can do a better job of that with some more effort. And we can also be more patient and see if we can get more of the upturn on the powder. And we're also going to work on measuring to lower temperatures on the single crystal. Another thing we do is we analyze our data with only 600 seconds. We're looking at the initial 600 seconds, and then we can get data that's similar to Klemke's work. And so what's happening is we're getting it looks like when we only look at the first 600 seconds of data, we can get the Pauling entropy as they were getting, the residual Pauling entropy, but only when you wait long enough do you start seeing the ordering occurring into this other state. And so if we look at the entropy as a function of temperature, we can see the Klemke work flattening out over here. Actually, this is Ramirez's work, and Klemke's would be closer to that value. But what our data is doing is as we go to low temperatures, it goes beyond that. And then it looks like if you look carefully, it's picking up speed. And well, that's consistent with the fact that that is due to the an upturn over here in the C over T. And so we don't know what state it is. It could be this MDG state. But what happens is someone needs to do neutron scattering or other kinds of measurements to determine what the ordering is. And what we can look at is the time constant for this relaxation. And what we can see is that the time constant we saw in the specific heat, if we look at the long time, if we do a kind of a rough estimate of the time constant of our thermal relaxation, we see that it's consistent with the Arrhenius behavior that we were seeing in the susceptibility, and that it's closer actually than the magnetization measurements from Matsuhira's group. One of the things you also look like if you look at is if you feel that this Arrhenius behavior should still continue to be held, then this data point here should actually be a million seconds and not 200,000 seconds. And so maybe we didn't wait long enough, and that point there should actually be coming up. So I would say out of these points, this one here is a little bit suspect, and maybe if we waited longer, then the heat capacity of that value could even be higher. Okay. And one of the things is with these time constants being so long, this is maybe a good guide for other experiments like neutron scattering and muon USR, is that you don't want to be at 1 Kelvin and then barrel down to 300 milli-K or 50 milli-K. That's not the best way to get the system into the low temperature state, because what you're actually going to likely do is quench the system into a state somewhere around here, not allowing it to thermalize and equilibrates to this temperature. So it's probably, you can come up with a nice model which of a cooling rate, an optimal cooling rate, to get the system into entering this ordered state. When we take this data, what we do is we step down. So we make this measurement, we step down to this point, we step down to this point. And so this might be many days, get slowing down to weeks by the time we get down to there. And so it might be that for neutron scattering people, they might not have that much time, but that what they could do is come up with a compromise by looking at the amount of entropy that we see has been picked up. They might have enough signal to be able to identify some ordering at some higher temperature. Okay, so then that's the summary, is that we see an upturn in the specific heat that hasn't been seen before, and that's consistent with a prediction from quite some time ago by Gingras' group. And actually, you should say that you might want to talk to Michel Gingras. He had his group has been working on this and has some results of looking at the interactions within this model to see if there's a explanation for the upturn over here. And I think they presented something, so you could talk to them about it. And let's see what else. Yeah, that's it. Thanks.
For maybe one quick question at most.
So your statement is that previous neutron experiments that looked for magnetic ordering just didn't cool it slow enough for it to relax potentially.
That's, I would expect, if they didn't wait long enough. If they're not aware of how long they have to wait, they maybe didn't do that. I think Bruce might know about the different groups. I mean, I think you were saying that maybe Bramwell waited a long time but I'm not sure if they cool down way too quickly and then waited. You don't just cool down to 50 millik and wait 3 days. That's not the best way to do it. It would probably be better to go to, let's say, 500 or 450 millik and wait for several days. And so I don't know if they did that.
Yeah, probably not. It's
Okay, let's thank Jan for a very interesting talk.